For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, I was asked to speak on the subject, Joseph, overcoming obstacles through faithfulness. And when Mike got in contact with me and asked me to speak on this subject, I said, yeah, I really love Joseph. What a great illustration of his life from the Old Testament. When I think about Joseph, I do think about obstacles, and I also think about faithfulness. I don't know what I would have done if I'd have been in his situation, but I'm so thankful for his example. And so tonight we want to go right into his life and look at some of the obstacles, some of the barriers, some of the problems, some of the challenges that he faced. And one of the things that stands out immediately is he came from a dysfunctional family. When I say dysfunctional family, I mean dysfunctional. And I just went back and reflected on a lot of that dysfunction. For example, when we look at his grandparents. Now, his grandparents, really, Isaac and Rebekah, were terribly dysfunctional. They had their moments of glory, but they also had tremendous periods of time of serious problems in their lives. Their problems, Joseph's problems, go back to his grandparents, obviously, but they... When you look at his grandparents, it goes all the way back to Adam and Eve. It goes all the way back to the garden. Because once sin entered into the world, you had an incredible dysfunctional family. With Cain and Abel and all the problems that came with that. But in Genesis chapter 25, verse 28, it says, Isaac, that's his grandpa, Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau. Esau was his firstborn. But Rebekah, his wife, Joseph's grandma, loved Jacob. Now that tells you immediately there's going to be a problem in that family. That's what you call favoritism. And when you get into that story and you see how it all worked, it's an incredible story. Isaac at times could be incredibly passive. Rebekah was incredibly manipulative. She helped Jacob actually steal the blessing from Esau, who was the eldest. She manipulated, lied, and controlled that situation. She lied to Isaac about the whole situation. Had Jacob feigned that he was Esau in order to get that blessing. Made Esau so angry that he wanted to kill Jacob. Literally, and that's when Rebekah had to come up with a scheme to get him out of town so his brother wouldn't kill him. That's dysfunction. That's horrible dysfunction. But it's not only there in the grandparenting scene, but you see it in his own parents with Jacob. Jacob had to run for his life, and that's an incredible story on how he goes back, in a sense, to his homeland further north where Abraham came eventually. And he's going up there to find a wife. And Rebekah said, you know, to Isaac, we've got to get him out of town because he might marry one of these Hittite women. Well, she didn't tell him the truth as to why she really wanted him to leave. She knew that Esau was going to try to kill him. Eventually, though, he meets Rachel. And he falls deeply in love with Rachel. And he goes to his uncle Laban and he said, I would like to marry Rachel. And Laban said, you can have her if you work for her 7 years. He loved her so much, he worked 7 years. And it said the time just flew by because he loved her so much. Wedding day came. And old Uncle Laban had a deceptive plot. You see, Rachel had a sister who was older. Her name was Leah. And so consequently, he wanted to marry her off first. So I don't know how he did all this, but somehow he got Rachel and hid her away and tied her up, and she must have been a screaming mess. while he presents Leah, and Jacob goes into the tent that night, probably drunk, because he didn't realize that it was Leah rather than Rachel. He didn't realize until he woke up the next morning. And I think the most humorous statement in the Bible, one of them, is, "And there was Leah." And he came out of that tent, I'm sure, like a wild bull, and said, "Why did you do this to me?" Well, it's interesting that Jacob was noted as being a deceiver himself. And what goes around comes around. And what went around came around in his life, because Laban deceived him tremendously by doing what he did in providing him with Leah rather than Rachel. By the way, the word Jacob means deceiver. And Isaac and Rebekah called him Jacob because when he was born, he was the second born. When he came out of the womb, either instinctively or some way, he had a hold of his brother's leg. They were twins. And the word deceiver in Hebrew, which is also Jacob, actually means trickery or deception. It was like a wrestling term, that a move that you put on your opponent in deception. And so they called him Jacob, deceiver. They thought it was real cute until he became a deceiver. And his brother said, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob? He stole my blessing. He stole my birthright." Well, what goes around comes around. And here he is deceived. But he loves Rachel. And so Laban said, "Look, if you work another 7 years, I'll give her to you in a week. But you got to work another 7 years for me." And so he did. But this is the beginning of tremendous dysfunction. That statement itself says it, doesn't it? We saw favoritism in his grandparents. You see favoritism now with his wife. Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. And of course, from the beginning of time, if God had designed for a man to have more than one woman, he would have made more than one woman for Adam. But he didn't. And this was God tolerated this in the midst of all this sin and all of this debauchery and all these problems that were going on within the New Testament world, even within God's chosen people. And so you know what favoritism created there. Leah was very unhappy with the fact that he loved Rachel. He didn't let that was not a secret. And so you have dysfunction, tremendous dysfunction within his parents. But as a result of that marriage, or marriages, you have even more dysfunction with all of his brothers, the sons of Jacob. In Genesis 37:2, this is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man of 17, he's now grown up to be a young man. He was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their fathers a bad report about them. Now, Bilhah and Zilpah happened to be the handmaids of the two other women that we have involved here in relationship to Jacob's wives. And so consequently, what happened is that Leah has five children. And of course, the other wife gets incredibly unhappy with this. And so she gives Jacob her handmaid and says, "Have children with him because I want children." Well, then Leah stops having children after having them. And she said, "Now you take my handmaid," and that's Zilpah and Bilhah. And they had four boys. But they're out here now as the sons of Jacob, herding the sheep, and Joseph brings back a report to his father about these four sons. And we can only imagine their behavior to receive a bad report. It no doubt had to do with incredible immorality. And if you read anything about the laws that were given at Sinai, you can put together some of the horrible things that these guys were doing. So there's your example for Joseph. Bad examples. Not just with these four boys that were born of the handmaids, but of the other boys that were born from Jacob's legitimate wives. So you have a horrible situation. Grandparents, parents, brothers. But then you have another problem. Jacob really didn't learn the problem of favoritism. Because notice what we have in Genesis 37:3. Now Israel, that is Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. Again, favoritism. Because he had been born to him in his old age. And he even went a step further to show this favoritism by making his son this richly ornamented robe. And this was not just some little colorful coat. This was a robe fit for a prince. And all the other brothers knew it. They knew that he was favored. And they hated him because of this favoritism. The scriptures are very clear. They hated him so much that they wanted to kill him. And that leads to our next major point in terms of his obstacles. We've looked at the dysfunctional family, but you have what I've called abandonment and slavery. In Genesis 37:28, he sold to Midianite merchants. Genesis 37:28, so when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern or the pit. Now what happened was that when Joseph came with his brightly colored coat, and they saw him coming, they said, "Here he comes. Let's get him." They wanted to kill him. But Reuben decided that, no, let's not kill him. Let's just put him in a pit. And he wanted to get him back to his father. There's another reason for that, by the way, because Reuben had committed a very horrible sexual sin, incest, and he was out of favor with his father. So he's going to try to make that up by taking care of Joseph. But it didn't work because these Midianite merchants came along. They pulled him out of the pit. Reuben didn't realize this. And they sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt. He's 17 years old. Are those obstacles or are those obstacles? 17 years old. Against the backdrop of all of this sin and evil and debauchery, favoritism, corruption, lying, deceiving, he's sold into Egypt. He goes on the auction block. And so we read on when he gets to Egypt. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, Potiphar, very, very wealthy individual, an Egyptian who is one of Pharaoh's officials, actually the guy that probably protected the king. The captain of the guard brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. So he's sold as a slave into Egypt. He's taken in to this gentleman's home, Potiphar. Well, God blessed him, so much so that Potiphar trusted him with absolutely everything. All of his money, all of his operations, all of his slaves, all of his wheat fields, all of his investments, and Joseph was in charge. But then Joseph faced another serious problem. Sexual harassment and abuse. An incredible story. And we read about this in Genesis 39. Now Joseph was well built. He was a very handsome young guy. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, very bluntly, "Come to bed with me." No ands and ifs about that invitation. And this went on day after day after day, but Joseph refused. We read about this in Genesis 39. If you go on, now Joseph, next slide. And though she spoke to Joseph day after day. Can you imagine this young, dynamic, handsome young man? And by the way, since she was Potiphar's wife, she was in charge of all the servants. And Joseph was a servant. So in resisting her advances, he was actually resisting the one who had authority over him as well. But he said, I can't do this. I can't violate God's law. And by the way, that was before the law was given at Mount Sinai. In his heart, he knew this was wrong. He said, I can't violate the trust that Potiphar has put in me. I can't do that. But she kept after him day after day. He refused to go to bed with her, to even be with her. He avoided her, which intensified, I'm sure, her desire to seduce him. And one day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. Who do you suppose arranged for all those servants to be outside? She was in charge of all those servants. She had set the stage. She knew his whereabouts. She knew he would be coming. And she caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and he ran out of the house. Now, it doesn't take too much imagination to realize what kind of perseverance and commitment it took on the part of that young man to avoid that kind of trap. But he did. It's absolutely amazing. But that leads then to a false accusation. Here is where things really get nasty. Because lust can turn to hate very, very quickly. She kept his cloak beside her till his master came home, and then she told him the story. This story. That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me, make sport of me. In other words, he tried to seduce me. It goes on. Next slide. But as soon as I screamed for help, and you can see that she's in a dither. She's foaming at the mouth with anger. Screaming. I scream for help. You talk about lying, deception. He left his cloak beside me. He ran out of the house. And when his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me. He burned with anger. And here's an interesting thought. Why was he angry? He wasn't stupid. Don't you think he knew all about his wife? Of course he did. He had a lot of servants in that house. All he had to do is call in one servant and say, what really happened? You tell me or else. And believe me, he would have had the whole story just like that. And you can better believe that he had the whole story. He was angry at her and the circumstances of that situation because he had to put in prison the guy that was in charge of everything he owned. He lost his right-hand man. Now, another reason why I believe that he knew all about it and he was angry at her is because he put him in prison. He was the right-hand man to the king, to protect the king, the captain of the guard, and he had every right to have Joseph's head. But he didn't. He put him in prison instead. But he had to save face. He had to do something. That's my perspective. Joseph is a victim of harassment, of abuse, of lying, and now he ends up in prison because of false accusations. Incredible story, isn't it? You know, isn't it interesting how God doesn't waste words? He just lays it all out. He just tells us everything. That's one reason why I believe this Bible is the Word of God. Because if it was written by man, it would try to make us look good. God just tells it like it is. This is the story. These are the facts. But then there's another painful 2 years. Even though God blessed him in prison, he was trusted and entrusted. He had a serious betrayal and was forgotten. And we read about that in Genesis 40, 14 and 23. There were two guys that got in serious trouble, the cupbearer and the baker. And they come into prison. They have dreams. And Joseph is able to tell them the meaning of their dreams. And so he says to one of the men, the cupbearer, "But when all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Potiphar or to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. Would you return the favor? I don't belong here. I've been through hell and high water. And I need your help. Somebody to represent me. I have no representative in this situation." And I'm sure he reviewed some of the facts, although cautiously. But here's one of the sad parts of the story. The cupbearer, who got this good news from Joseph, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. That's betrayal. That's when you do something for someone that actually literally helped save his life and the person doesn't even remember. How do you think Joseph felt? Another painful barrier and experience in his life. But then we begin to see the healing process take place. He does become the prime minister of Egypt because he was able to foretell and explain the dreams of the Pharaoh about the wheat and the cows and the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine. And because of his skill and his ability and his being able to unfold the future in these prophetic statements, he does become prime minister. He's in charge of everything in Egypt, you know, from prison to palace, almost overnight. And then this famine that went all the way to Canaan begins to bring the story together as the brothers come down to get wheat and get food, lest they starve. And there is Joseph seeing those men, 10 of them. Benjamin is not there. He recognizes every one of them. Can you imagine the memories that begin to flood through his mind and his soul? They didn't recognize him. Clean shaven, looked like an Egyptian, in his royal robes. And Joseph puts them to the test. But you begin to see the healing taking place in his life spiritually when you look at his tears. Big boys do cry. Men cry. And Joseph wept. 7 times he wept. And as you study his tears, you begin to see this emotional and spiritual healing taking place. Let me just review for you those tearful situations. Joseph wept when he saw his brothers' hearts begin to soften in their relationship to God because he put them to the test and they didn't know that he could understand their language. And he heard their brothers saying, "We know we shouldn't have done that." He began to say, "God is punishing us because of what we did to Joseph." And at one point, he had to turn away because he began to see some sorrow, some at least something that looked like repentance. At least sorrow that they got themselves into this mess and now they're going to be in trouble. Because Joseph really put them to the test. He called them spies. "You're spies." And it took a lot of guts for him to say that. He was just testing them. "You're spies." And in his heart he was saying, "I can't believe I'm saying this to my brothers." He wanted to know the truth. What was going on in their hearts? And when he found out, when there was that crack, he wept. There was healing in that moment as he got in touch with those feelings. He also wept. Next slide. He wept out of compassion when he learned that his brother Benjamin had not suffered the same plight he had suffered. And this gives us a clue that during those years of imprisonment and difficulty in his life, he thought of his little brother Benjamin. Did they do the same thing to Benjamin? He was his blood brother. They had the same mama. Did they do it? Did they kill him? He's not there. Where is he? And when he begins to find out that his brother Benjamin had not suffered his plight, again, he wept. Tells a lot about the memories that he had after he was sold into Egypt, about his little brother Benjamin. We also see him wept. He wept because he saw Judah's true concern for his father Jacob. You see, those brothers went home and told a lie. They took the coat of many colors and bathed it in blood from an animal and took it home and said, "Dad, isn't this the coat?" And yes, it is. And he must have been killed by a wild animal. And Jacob mourned and wept for months. He loved Joseph. And when he heard that Judah, one of his brothers, was concerned about Jacob and said, "We're going," when he was putting them to the test, Joseph put them to the test, they were saying, "We can't do this because Dad'll die. He'll have a heart attack." And that was good news. He's still alive. And they're concerned about him. That's a change. And he wept. He wept when he was reconciled with his brothers. Once he revealed himself and said, "Brothers, I am Joseph." They were stunned. Once he had taken them through the test and he began to realize that they were different men than the men that had sold him into slavery. And there they wept and cried together. Joseph wept when he was reunited with his father, when he came down. It's a beautiful scene. He also wept when his father died and they brought him down into Egypt. He wept when he saw the grief caused by his brother's lingering guilt. And this is the culmination of a story that is really incredible. And that leads us, you see, to seeing purpose in suffering. Genesis chapter 50, verses 19 through 20. And what happened in the background to this, where Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God?" See, after their daddy died, the brothers were really nervous. They were still feeling guilt. They weren't sure of Joseph and how much he really cared about them. And they got together and they say, we need to concoct a story here, and we need to tell Joseph that Jacob, and that he knows how much Jacob loved him, but we've got to go and we've got to say that Jacob, our father, when he died, we need to say to Joseph, "Would you protect my brothers?" That this is what Jacob really wants. They used their father. They made up the story. Because they were scared to death. They said, "Now that our dad is dead, now he'll get us. Now we'll see the real Joseph. Now we'll see him get even with us." They couldn't believe that he had forgiven them. But notice, Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me. You intended to harm me. That's right. I acknowledge that. But God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the savings of many lives." Because as a result of that event, the whole clan was able to come down into Egypt and settle into Egypt, all 70 people that were in that family, and that, of course, was the beginning of the expansion of the children of Israel. Obstacles? Joseph faced them. But he overcame them through his faithfulness to God. He was growing in the process himself. But the end of the story is in some respects beautiful. And I'd like to leave you with, as you look back on this story, with four principles. Call them principles to live by from the life of Joseph. No matter what our family background and negative experiences, we are to trust God to enable us to forget what is behind and to move forward in our lives. Now, let me explain. Do you think that Joseph ever forgot the pain that he felt when he was thrown into that pit? Did he ever forget that? No. Did he ever forget what it was like to be sold to those Midianite merchants? What it was like to be sold on an auction block at just a young man of 17? Do you think he ever forgot what it was like, the feelings that he had when he was harassed by Potiphar's wife? Do you think he ever forgot what it was like to be in prison and falsely accused? Do you think he ever forgot what it was like to be betrayed by the butler who forgot him? See, to forget what is behind is not to forget the events or the circumstances. Because if you forget the circumstances, it's a result of repression and denial. He never forgot those events. But as he worked through all of these issues, and even during the process, he was able to trust God, even though he didn't understand what was happening. Even when he told the butler to say to Pharaoh, "I don't belong here." He was able to trust God, not to turn against God. To forget what is behind and to press on is not to allow the past to control us, to keep us in bondage to ourselves, to keep us in a situation where we won't forgive, a situation where anger obsesses us and drives us. You see, there's a principle that we can learn from the life of Joseph. No matter what our family background, and wow, what a family background he had. What negative experiences. And yet we're to trust God as he did to enable us to forget what is behind, move forward in our lives. To go through life punishing other people who are responsible for our hurt is only going to turn around and punish ourselves. To put ourselves in bondage, not to be free in Christ. There's a second principle. Though it may take time, we must forgive those who have sinned against us in order to experience emotional and spiritual healing. Somewhere in that process, Joseph forgave his brothers. Don't know exactly where it happened. I tend to believe, in light of the whole story, it happened even before his brothers came down to Egypt. He had to deal with that issue in his life. He began to see some meaning, some purpose, which enabled him to forgive. Forgiveness is something that's totally misunderstood, by the way. Forgiveness doesn't involve a feeling, it involves an action. It involves a decision. Where we forgive as an act of the will and say, "I forgive," just as Jesus forgave those who were nailing him to the cross and said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I'm not sure Jesus really felt good about that moment, in that pain and in that agony, when he said, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Forgiveness is an act of the will. And as we continue to remind ourselves that we have forgiven, we don't allow ourselves to retreat back into anger and let it control us, eventually we can experience healing in our lives and the feelings that follow. We may never forget the events. Probably we never will. But we can look at those events and not allow those events to cause us to be angry and hostile and bitter. And that happened to Joseph through God's grace. Which leads us to another principle. We must get in touch with our feelings in order to facilitate the healing process. Did you see the healing process in Joseph's life? I think God has told us. He wept. 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 7 times. And you see the progression. That's getting in touch with your feelings. There's healing in expressing those feelings. And we see it in Joseph's life. He was a human being just like you and just like me. But we'll never really work through the healing process unless we learn to feel the pain and the hurt, but not allow it to control us, to lead to the process of forgiveness. And then number 4, dynamic principle. No matter what our circumstances in life, no matter what our circumstances in life, and I can tell you, there are circumstances in life, in some respects, that are almost worse than Joseph's. I'm sure they're worse than Joseph's. And one of the circumstances of life that I don't understand and I don't comprehend and I can't identify with, thank God, and a circumstance that makes me angry when I think about it, and that's when a child is sexually abused. I don't think that ever happened to Joseph. He was exposed to all kinds of immorality, but I don't think he was ever abused as a little child. And through sexual abuse, there is an incredible, intricate aspect of our personality that is touched beyond a child's comprehension and ability to understand. And it's hard to even get in touch with those feelings. And yet, I've seen remarkable things happen and healing take place through the process of forgiveness. I see people forgive people who've done horrible things to them, and I stand in amazement because I can't even identify what it would be like. Thank God. All that I know is that I've seen some of those people come through that trauma and through that experience and come into healing, and they have a greater ministry in people's lives than I'll ever have because they've been there. They can say, I know how you feel, and yet this is what God did for me. By the way, don't ever tell somebody you know how they feel when you haven't been there, because inwardly, they're saying, oh, no, you don't. Oh, no, you don't. And there are times I've had to stand with people and put my arms around them and say nothing. If I say anything is, I don't know how you feel, but I love you. But I know that great healing can take place in people's lives. No matter what our circumstances in life, and there are wicked circumstances, we should ask God to help us see some purpose, some meaning in our suffering, even though we may not understand it completely until we are with Christ. And men and women, there are certain things that you will never understand until you are with Jesus. Job, he didn't know why he was going through all the pain he went through. When he lost his family, he lost everything he owned. Why his own friends turned against him. For a long period, he didn't understand it. At the end of his life, he understood it. And God restored. But men and women, there are some people that go through life and they die. And they'll never know until they're with Jesus. Why? And that's the most difficult. But we must trust God. There is purpose beyond anything that we can ever understand or comprehend in this life. One of the greatest stories that has impacted my life, I first read about him, is a man by the name of Viktor Frankl. He was a Jewish psychiatrist. He had developed an approach to therapy called logotherapy, which really means word therapy, which really means seeing meaning in suffering. Helped a lot of people. And then he was taken into captivity by the Nazis, put in a Nazi concentration camp. He tells the story. People are dying around him. They're just giving up on life. They don't have any energy to get out of bed. They're working all day, but they're starving. And he said, I got up one day, and by the way, when he was taken into a Nazi concentration camp, the Nazis destroyed all of his books, all of his materials, burned them, threw them away. And he's sitting on the edge of his bunk, and he can hardly get out of bed. And he leans down and he ties what's left of his shoes. He ties them on with baling wire, and he takes his clothes and he has some string to hold up what little clothes that he had that were falling apart. He has a crust of bread and he's on his way to the mines, walking on frozen ground. And he said, I felt like I was going to die. I could hardly take one step in front of another. And then he said, I thought about what I've been telling people who are in trouble in my counseling. Try to see some meaning in what's happening, some purpose. And he said, the only purpose that I could come up with as I was trudging along was that I saw in my mind's eye, I was standing in a huge auditorium and I was talking to a group of people and I was sharing with them how I was able to overcome this horrible situation and survive and to be able to be in that auditorium telling them the purpose I saw, that I was there to tell them what I saw. That it worked. He said, that's the only thing I could come up with. And he said, I got some energy. I took another step, another step. Day after day, he made it through until he was released from prison, from that horrible camp. My wife and I were sitting in our home in Dallas, and I opened the paper and I saw a notice that there was a special speaker at the University of Dallas. It's a Roman Catholic university. His name was Dr. Viktor Frankl. I'd read his story. I'd told his story. I said to Elaine, we've got to go hear Frankl. And so we went. I sat there in the auditorium. I was there. I heard him tell the story that I had read. But now I'm the audience that was the audience of his mind. when the only thing that gave him strength was to be able to see himself some future day in an auditorium telling a group of people, I survived because I saw some meaning, and the meaning was to tell you I'm here. And I survived. You can imagine what I was feeling, because I had been the part of the audience of his mind when he was in that Nazi concentration camp. And as he stood there and shared this story, folks, I don't even know whether he was a believer at that point. He had professed Christianity. Only God knows his heart. But I thought to myself, if that works for Viktor Frankl, when he was an unbeliever, if he saw some meaning and it gave him strength, what about me? What about a Christian who really understands Romans 8:28? That all things work together for good to those that love the Lord, to those that are called according to his purpose. See, that's what Joseph said to his brothers. You meant it to me for evil, but God meant it to me for good. That's Romans 8:28 in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, Paul stated it. We know that all things work together for good to those who love the Lord, to those who are called according to his purpose. If it worked for Frankl, that really ought to work for us who know Jesus Christ personally, who have the biblical story, the story of Joseph, but not just the story of Joseph, but the whole story of the Old Testament, leading into the New Covenant and the New Testament and the coming of Jesus, dying for us on a cross to give us new life in Christ and eventually an eternity with him forever. And I would have to say, in all honesty, that there are some situations where people will never know how all things work together for good to those who love the Lord until they're face to face with Jesus Christ. But I believe that's true. It's good to see meaning and purpose now. And I know in my own life, as I've gone through trials and difficulties, to be able to say, there's got to be something I can learn from this, something God's teaching me from this, and I can draw strength from that. But there are situations that will only be unveiled in eternity. In that sense, we're like some of the Old Testament greats who by faith saw but never experienced the reality until they were present with God. Joseph, overcoming obstacles through faithfulness. I guess we'll have a little time of question, and let's take about 10 minutes, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions I can. Can't guarantee it, but if you have a question, something you'd like to say, please feel free. I think we got a hand right down here. Do we have a microphone?
Said that forgiveness is an action and not a feeling, and then you mentioned how the difficult pain of sexual abuse. Can you describe more about that process as you see it and hear it for sexual abuse victims?
Well, basically the bottom line would be that through counseling and help and encouraging the person to be able to do what Joseph did, and that is not to deny what happened, but to experience it and talk about it with a counselor in a personal kind of situation, is in that situation is to say that very thing, that forgiveness is an act of the will. Because there are people that have very difficult time with forgiveness because they think it's a feeling. And they say, I don't have that feeling. I don't have a feeling that I want to forgive. And so you have to explain to them very gently and sensitively to forgive as an act of the will and allow God then to bring healing through that process. And you have to be very sensitive with that. I remember trying to lead a girl to Christ one time. She was actually early 20s, and she was responsive to the gospel. And I said, Evelyn, she was ready, I thought, to receive Christ. And I said, Evelyn, just you can pray this prayer after me. I'll pray these words, because she wasn't used to praying. And so I began the prayer by, I said, Dear Father. Silence. And I thought she misunderstood. And so I said, well, Evelyn, you can just repeat after me. And so I started over. I said, Dear Father. Silence. And I said, Evelyn, is there something wrong? She said, I can't use that word. I said, you can't use the word Father. I can't use that word. Well, what she explained to me, when she was just a little girl, her father sexually abused her. And so just the name Father conjured up an image. She could not use that word to identify God. So in that particular situation, I said, well, Evelyn, you don't have to say Father. You can say God. So we started over. Dear God. I avoided the word, being sensitive to her. Now, she prayed that prayer, but I do know that in her life, it took a while for her to work through the process of forgiving her father and being freed up from that. Not that she ever condoned what he did. And forgiving somebody doesn't mean you agree with what they've done. I remember that in our church situation, happened several years ago, an arsonist came into our church offices and started in my office in a couch where I was counseling this couple. And I can't tell you all the situations, but he got so angry that later he entered our office building, poured gasoline on that couch, hit four other places in the office, took out 50 of our offices, 17 pastors lost their libraries, including yours truly, destroyed everything. And that happened on a Monday morning about 1 o'clock. This has all been reconstructed. We were able to reconstruct it and who it was. Never, by the way, able to bring him in because he destroyed all the evidence. And in 95% of the case where there's arsonists, they know who the arsonist is, but they don't have enough evidence to bring the grand jury. So he got away with it, though they tried to bring him in. But Wednesday night, it's happened Monday night, Wednesday night I had to go before the whole congregation and lead them in forgiveness of this man and what he had done. Do you think I struggled between Monday and Wednesday? Because with an act of the will, I had to forgive that man for what he did. Before I could lead other people into forgiveness. And so with an act of the will, I led these people to forgive him. But then we went to pray for justice. Because justice is in God's will too. That people who commit crimes should be brought to justice. But we had to turn that over to God and the authorities, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. That was a tough time. But it taught me a lot about forgiveness. And by the way, the Sunday before he did that, I preached on Joseph and forgiveness. And I can still see him sitting in the audience listening to my message. Now, the guy had serious problems. I mean, really serious problems. Sexual problems of all sorts and varieties. I couldn't even tell you. I knew things about him I couldn't even tell the congregation, because Ted Koppel at that time would have been out the next day doing Nightline. Really, I'm serious. I had to keep a lot of information to myself that I discovered about him and why he attacked us that way. But anyway, I just bridged over to that story in relationship that forgiveness is an act of the will is not easy. Feelings follow. And as I talk about it right now, Yes, I hope this man has come to know Christ. I pray for him particularly. But I can get angry at him right now as I recall this, because he put us through such pain. But the feelings have followed. You know, don't let that bother me. But that was a hard time. I lost 40 Bibles that he burned up that I'd used for teaching and preaching over the years. And I wasn't the only pastor that did that. So, you know, it was that God was... And by the way, in seeing purpose in this, I've told you I'm going to give you time for questions. I've got to tell you another story. It relates to this one. I go into this building with my wife, beams hanging everywhere, and in my office, nothing but ashes where my books were and my desk. It's all gone. And my wife is there, and they let us get in. The building inspector let us come in. We had hard hats. I had a big scoop shovel. And it just so happened that on that credenza, I had a metal sculpture of Moses with the Ten Commandments that was given to me by a Portuguese artist, a very familiar Portuguese artist, a metal sculpturist. It was an incredible sculpture. It was given to me as a gift. I had it sitting there, and I said to Elaine, I just wonder if maybe that sculpture survived. So I took my scoop shovel, and I dug into the ashes, and I turned it over. And what do you suppose was there? The sculpture? No. Now, here's God's humor. I wrote a book, a big tome, called A Biblical Theology of Material Possessions. And I kid you not, when I turned it over, that book was fully intact, looking at me. You could read the cover of the book, and today it's in my office in a glass case. And if I took you there, I could open that book and you could read every word. And I turned to my wife, and I was laughing. And it was like God saying, Gene, do you believe what you wrote in that book? It's the only thing that survived in that office. So I said, Lord, there is some meaning in this horrible situation. You've just taught me a lesson. So another question, and then we'll... take a break. Yes, sir. Over here.
My question is about Joseph, and when I studied Joseph before, I looked at his life, and I think this is a guy who is almost spotless. I know you made a comment about how, you know, the Bible tells it how it is, and this, and we don't really seem to see any like sin that Joseph did, like until maybe. When I was reading it, I understood that him testing his brothers was like a revenge almost, or a way that he was getting back at them. But did you say that he was, you think that was hard on him, or that was a difficult thing for him to do?
To
test his brothers by...
Oh,
you know,
yeah, I think it really did. That's why he went, he would go to a private room and weep. And one time he wept so loud, they thought he was crazy. Everybody thought he was nuts. I'm sure the brothers didn't hear it, but the servants around heard him. I think that he wasn't taking revenge what he was doing. And by the way, there's another principle there, and it's not wrong to test people to make sure that they're sincere. Because all he knew of his brothers was evil. So how does he know that they're not the same? How did he know they didn't kill Benjamin? Do the same thing to Benjamin? How did they know that... what they did to his dad. See, he didn't have any, email. He didn't have any way of knowing what was going on back there. And so he's testing them. And there's another principle. It's not wrong to test people with right motives, your motives, to make sure they're telling the truth. And that's what, and finally when he realized, hoping against hope, that they were for real, then the real relief came, and that's where he said, guys, look, he even cried that they were worrying. That shows his heart. Now, in terms of his character and his behavior. He was a very unusual young man, but we really don't know much about his character traits that are positive until he was 17 and from that point forward. But he had to be arrogant as well. For example, he probably came there with his coat of many colors. You know, he was arrogant. By the way, his dad was stupid. His dad was stupid to send him out with that robe of many colors, knowing those brothers hated him. Jacob knew that. And so he sends him right into the trap. That shows how stupid Jacob was. He set him up. So there's a lot of confusion going on there, and difficult to sometimes to unravel it all. I'm sure that Joseph had the same characteristics as any young man growing up, with arrogance and whatever, but we just don't know anything about the first 17 years. We know from 17 on that it was incredible, his character, and how he withstood the temptation against Potiphar's wife is beyond understanding almost. I mean, that's beyond comprehension, because she was his boss and he could have rationalized, I mean, you know, but he didn't. And that kind of temptation is unbelievable, that he was able to withstand that. And that was before he even knew God's command, thou shalt not commit adultery. It wasn't given yet from Mount Sinai. It's amazing, isn't it? Okay. I think we better give it a rest here, okay?
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.